Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 11th. Today's session is entitled Poetry in Grief, Part 1, presented by Kathy Schwinn, number SCK-2006-06. Let's listen in.
I think this is so neat that now that they record from like a computer system, so I can say, oh, start the recording, and actually no one's listening yet.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting? My name is Kata, as I said, and when I'm not here, I live in Iowa City, and I just finished graduate school at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and so with a bunch of other fabulous teachers who are here this week, I will be starting to teach at Augustana College in Rock Island next year. And today, we are going to do a bunch of things, and hopefully we will have enough time to do them all. I'm not going to give too much of a preview about how the session is going to go. Instead, we're just going to start out with a poem, and I'm going to look at it, read pretty closely, and I want very honest impressions from all of you about what you think of the poem and things like that. And because this is, I will remind people, a Holden discussion, it means that everyone's opinion and ideas are not only welcome, but sort of necessary for us to really have a full and good discussion about this kind of stuff. And this isn't astrophysics, so there's not right answers. It's an interpretation. So I will read this once, and then if, as we're reading through, I'd like to hear it again in somebody else's voice. So if you're feeling like, you want to do it a second time?
I don't care. I was asking before.
For a second, we're not going to worry about who it's by. We're just going to look at the poem itself, and I'm not going to tell you when it was written, and I'm not going to tell you the gender of the poet. We're just going to look at the poem itself.
I'd say it's English by the title.
English poet? It could be in translation as well.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not even going to tell you what continent this poet is from. I will tell you, not Antarctica. That's all I'm getting. Okay. What?
I couldn't think of that
You could have.
I was trying to think of that country in Africa.
Well, maybe next year you should go to Antarctica beforehand so you can participate more fully in that. Okay. Ash Manor. The ghost said nothing that added to our knowledge of the current situation at Ash Manor, only as he parted, your flesh would make delicious veal chops for hungry wolves. Then he called us his disciples. Like the slow emigration of the mad, in the half silence, I blew upon the lock of the door and it opened. I blew upon the candle which lit itself. It was not a dream, it was a puzzle. In my mouth there was a bowl of beef stew, but I could not eat it. I felt hungry, but it was not really hunger, only a feeling of hunger. Though, fortunately, observations on bees living in the tropics have thrown a little light on the question, as if I had bitten my throat with my own teeth. Nevertheless, the waves of the primeval ocean of Tantalassa were swashing over pet seals, Tex and Tulip. A cult was immediately formed whose solemn purpose it was to design new uniforms for the servants. Here was a sad emotion, belonging exclusively to the sphere of civilized man. Photographs were taken of a trumpet in the air. A rebuke, it nested there long after sunset in darkness. My eyes moistened, my great burning eyes. The dwarfs on my side were like myself, only much shorter and black. The dwarfs on the other side were real dwarfs, but they were really 6 feet tall like myself, or even 8 feet tall, but they looked as if they were no bigger than a child. I have a little dog, and they want to take him away from me. Machines are being installed in my head. Who would like to read this one again? Anyone feel like they would like to give it a shot? I'll give you a try?
Good.
The ghost said nothing that added to our knowledge of the current situation at Ash Manor. Only, as he parted, your flesh would make delicious veal chops for hungry wolves. Then he called us his disciples. Like the slow immigration of the mad, in the half-silence, I blew upon the lock of the door and it opened. I blew upon the candle, which lit itself. It was not a dream, it was a puzzle. In my mouth there was a bowl of beef stew, but I could not eat it. I felt hungry, but it was not really hunger, only a feeling of hunger. Though, unfortunately, observations on bees living in the tropics have thrown a little light on the question, as if I had bitten my throat with my own teeth. Nevertheless, the waves of the primeval ocean of Tantaleza were swashing over pet seals, Tex and Tula. A cult was immediately formed whose solemn purpose it was to design new uniforms for the servants. Here was a sad emotion belonging exclusively to the sphere of civilized man. Photographs were taken of a trumpet in the air, a rebuke. It nested there long after sunset in darkness. My eyes moistened, my great burning eyes. The dwarfs on my side were like myself, only much shorter and black. The dwarfs on the other side were real dwarfs, who were really 6 feet tall like myself, or even 8 feet tall, but they looked as if they were no bigger than a child. I have a little dog, and they want to take him away from me. Machines are being installed in my head.
All right, so any just kind of first initial responses, really honest. What do you think?
Schizophrenia,
okay. Meaning lots of different sort of voices that seem to be talking? Okay, great. What else?
Salvador Dali has become a poet.
Okay, great. Why?
Because the bizarre images in there are just like looking at one of his paintings.
Okay, so I'm going to write some of these things on the board.
Yeah, but I thought Magritte.
You thought what?
The artist Magritte, he paints things dangling in the air and...
Okay.
Day and night at the same time and so forth.
So,
by the way,
you said different voices. What else? Were you going to say something, Peter? You about to say something?
No, I was just going to say we have a new winner to our alliteration. It's Tex and Tula from Pantelism.
What else? Just initial responses. I mean, if you had to just use one word to describe this, and just like, what was that poem like?
Morbid.
Morbid, okay. Great. What else?
Not morbid.
Not morbid.
Disconnected,
great.
Conflicted,
disconnected, great. You guys are smart.
Okay. Sad.
Okay.
Good.
Anything else?
Lost. Paranoid.
These are great.
Flights of fantasy.
One word.
You guys are making my job hard.
I'm so stuck on rules.
Anything else? To me, I think the first word that jumps to my head is just kind of weird. I have to say, it feels weird. Anything else? Just initial first impressions.
It's like a little bizarre, but weird.
Bizarre, yeah.
Same thing.
Disorienting.
It's like a can. There's no... maybe at the end, at the very end. Before you get to the end, there's sort of like no place of repose in the poem.
Yes.
Rest.
That's good. Right?
You have to always be like on your toes, kind of waiting for the next kiss.
Yes. So things sort of keep...
No place of repose.
There's things kind of keep shifting. There's not really firm ground to stand on. And so let's go through it more slowly and kind of try to think... What are all the poetic techniques, and just to kind of get a handle on, what are the poetic techniques and devices that are being used here that give us these sensations? What is he doing? I mean, because sometimes I think people read a poem like this and they're like, well, this doesn't make any sense. I could just sit down and write the first five things that came into my head and it would have the exact same effect. But I don't think it's quite that easy. So we start out with the title here, Ash Manor. So you read Ash Manor. What sort of impression do you have already?
What's haunted house.
What?
Haunted house.
Great. Yes. What else?
An asylum.
Asylum. Okay. How come? That's a
He's looking, the very first sentence, the ghost is somebody there that's talking to him, and he wants to get out, he's not getting any answers.
Okay, so you're already in the first sentence, but just,
all of a sudden he starts getting in all these weird reflections or ideas, and I get the feeling that somehow he wants to get out, but these things keep coming in the way.
Wants to get out, it's trapped.
Yeah.
Trapped, that's great. Okay, what else? Anything just from the title?
Decrepit.
Decrepit, so things are falling apart, that sense of ash. How about color-wise?
Gray.
Okay, gray and ash, so this sense of disintegration. So before we even enter the poem, we have the sense of a place that's kind of in the process of disintegration. And what you've just given me here, your experience of the poem, kind of is feeling like that as you read it, that sense of things disintegrating and not connecting and falling apart.
The ash has two meanings because it's also a tree. So it
could
have once had a beautiful name and then now changed.
Wonderful.
This manor is also not something we live in. I mean, I live in a house. I don't think I would say it in a manor. There's a connotation or something.
Something sort of stately or
yes, exactly.
Elegant.
Yes.
Great.
Language. Well, I mean, at one point, you know, a manor would have been something very, upper class, but now it has that creepiness.
Yeah. So, okay, and then you're talking about the first line. The first thing we get is a ghost, right? Which is going to confirm pretty much everything that we've been thinking about Ash Manor. Oh, we're totally into the haunted house zone then. And we get, it's really interesting, I think, to take this first sentence just sort of a couple words at a time. So we get the ghost, and then we get the ghost said nothing. And then we get the ghost said nothing that added to our knowledge. So immediately, what's already happened to the ghost? What's the ghost doing?
Talking.
The ghost is talking, but yet in the first four words, the ghost said nothing, right? So
not only are we relying on a ghost and our knowledge.
Right, great. And we get R, right? So already we're a part of this, and we're relying on a ghost to add to our knowledge, but the ghost is saying nothing. Well, actually, the ghost is saying something. It's just not something that's adding to our knowledge. So already in the first sentence, we're just totally bummed. But added, the ghost said nothing that added to our knowledge of the current situation at Ash Manor. Okay, so what else? So we get of the current situation at Ash Manor, what else does that add to our idea of Ash Manor?
There may have been other situations.
Right, that this is a place where there have been situations before, and there is right now. So it's not totally decrepit. There's a situation there. There's something,
The ghost may be contributing
to the situation.
Right.
Right. Okay, so then we get nothing that added to our knowledge of the current situation at Ash Manor, only, except for this, as he parted, so he's checking out of the situation. And then, anybody want to deconstruct here the ghost's contribution to our knowledge here? Your flesh would make delicious veal chops for hungry wolves. Then he called us his disciples. What do you guys think about that?
Lambs left in slaughter.
Okay, great. So, hey, you're really vulnerable right now. Great. And as soon as we hear disciples, what kind of references are we getting?
Christian,
right? But it's kind of unclear what we're supposed to do with that. I mean, we sort of have the lambs being led to the slaughter, but he's kind of getting the Christian bomb kind of dropped there, but we're not sure how to kind of assimilate it into what we've just been given, right?
Well, somehow this
this delicious field chops. it connotes a kind of innocence to me.
Yeah, it's a veal baby cow.
Because the veal is a baby cow.
Yeah, not sheep.
Like you poor suckers, you know.
Well, and if we would make delicious veal chops, we don't know who the our is yet, so are we supposed to be baby cows? Is that who we are? Is it a metaphor? You know, what exactly is going on?
But this part about disciples sounds to me that he's leaving. Does this imply that we would be following him as his disciples?
Yes. Or staying behind? I mean, we've been dealing with the wish with you always great commissioning, right? Where Jesus is going to take off and say, see you later, make disciples of all nations, right? Well, this is very different. The ghost is taking off saying, you guys hang out with the current situation.
I'm sort of with the, we're stuck there, like the, what's the name of that movie? One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah. Okay. That's why I said asylum. I was thinking of that type of
situation.
Okay. Great. And yeah. And then the hungry wolves, too. It's kind of unclear whether, is that just theoretically you would make great meal chops for hungry wolves, or like there's hungry wolves circling Ash Manor right now that you guys are looking like you would be great. I mean, does anybody have a sense of which it is, or is it both?
That could be even the staff.
This is true. Yeah, we get the servants later. Yeah. Somebody was about to maybe say something.
I just get a sense of vulnerability that
he's
passing on to the viewers.
Great. I think that totally is the overriding kind of tone there, emphasizing that.
I think we're assuming we're in it's a narrative for a daily discourse. If this were inside a dream or someone reporting a dream, this is daily discourse, then all of that applies. Mm-hmm. If we're not in a place where daily discourse applies, or I don't want to say normal discourse, but information, communication, if you think of someone inside a dream, this,
it's all very normal.
It's sort of the way a dream works, isn't it?
Well, let's look at the next stanza, because we get a line that refers exactly to that when the speaker says, it was not a dream, it was a puzzle. So there's a sense of what would be the difference between a dream versus a puzzle?
I think his line is...
Yeah.
Okay.
Because God tells you you're in a dream, someone tells you this is not a dream, but it is.
Yeah.
Unreliable.
But if something's a puzzle, what does that mean?
You can figure it out.
You can figure it out. There's a solution. There's something, you maybe fit one other piece, and then we understand the complete picture. So that if you could just do something, everything else would be made clear. Whereas a dream, like Eunice is saying, has a completely different logic, and you never know if you're going to be able to figure it out. But I think the point that both are sort of true, that maybe you have an unreliable narrator, we seem to always kind of be going back and forth between those two things in this poem, in the sense that sometimes it seems like we're following dream logic and the images are totally surreal. Other times you get to the end, a line like, I have a little dog and they want to take him away from me, or machines are being installed in my head. And in some ways that does feel like, oh, maybe that is the key to unlocking the rest of what's come before. But it's not clear if it totally does unlock it. Okay, let's keep pushing. How about the slow immigration of the mad in the half silence? I blew upon the lock of the door and it opened. I blew upon the candle which lit itself. What do you guys notice about that?
It felt like ghost behavior to me. Ghost cave. I was like, is the ghost talking to us a little bit here all of a sudden?
Okay.
Or it was just, that sounds something a ghost would do, is blow up and candle lights, you know?
Okay, great. So the sort of, the ghost had this magical kind of reverse behavior.
Yeah,
or whoever's narrating is becoming the ghost. Yeah. I mean,
okay.
Yeah, like
all of a sudden, the things that are happening are ghost-like.
Right.
Yeah, is the immigration like intruding upon the person who's relating now, this slow immigration of the man.
And because the like begins that, it's unclear at the beginning of that sentence whether the like refers to him calling us his disciples, and that's being compared, like the slow immigration of the mad. I mean, as you read through, the like is actually referring to the blowing upon the lock of the door and it opened. That's the syntactic sort of reference in the sentence. But because of where it comes, usually when you get something, you get, you know, the subject is like the other subject, right? And here we have the like at the beginning, which then, do you see what I'm saying? So that the comparison sort of goes both ways. What else about that?
Well, it's a little bit, teeny bit empowering.
Okay.
Mostly, I mean, earlier, the whim of the ghost and the wolves and all these other, but here now you can do things. You can blow doors open, you can make candles light up. You have a little power.
So not something. As vulnerable anymore.
Yeah, seems that way.
Well, it's kind of fun, too, because in, like, some of those crazy horror shows, they do stuff like blow candles on.
Yeah.
You know, it's joke, I think, the 13th
day. I keep concerned, though. I see different things. I don't see the ghost as much as... There seems to be observations of reality, and then the lock is there, and then all of a sudden, miraculously, you can blow it and open it. There's I don't know what the social of ten colossus and that may be important in the pet seals, but there's a dog and it's taken away, and he's trying to work out the problem, and there'll be a set of facts and there'll be weird things happen, and that's why I keep thinking of this as being in some sort of a mental problem that something happens, it's observable, and then bang, something weird happens.
So there's a sense, that sense of
conflict
between what's real and what's
and
imagined.
And answers to it, or things that result from it.
Okay. Great. What, just because I get to so much stuff today, why don't we, people have, based on all of these things, the morbid versus not morbid, the sad versus, you know, not sad, or where are just, in sort of the rest of the poem, where are moments where it feels morbid, or feels, you actually get the emotion of that speaker to you, and what are moments where it almost feels ironic, or funny, or too bizarre to really even know how to place it?
The machines are being installed in my head. It just hit my gut. I don't know why. It's like, oh, man.
Yep.
Hard, you know? Hard or fun?
Hard.
Yeah,
like intense. And then I can see where it could be funny, but that to me was so compelling. And it just went into my ears, and I don't know.
You know what? I have an answer for you. Because I think if these two lines were at the start of the poem, I think we would have read right over them. Mm-hmm. But there was a kind of therapy in the 60s called primal therapy. Maybe some of you remember. And the idea was to, like, not let you sleep for, like, 24 hours, to sort of get you so vulnerable and disoriented that you were receptive to therapy. And in a way, that's what this poem does. It makes you, like, or for me anyway, it's so kind of disorienting and makes you feel, like, so, by the end, so confused and vulnerable that when you get hit with this line at the end, you, like, want to weep.
Yeah.
You know, just like... this little that they want to take this little dog away from him, you know.
So sad.
You just right. But if that had come at the beginning, it would not have had it would not have had that impact.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great
It seems as though thoughts were so out of control that someone is going to get this major loss of machines being installed in their head because they can't figure stuff out. Mm-hmm. And that just really, I think that's where the loss thing came for me. It's like, oh my word. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of profound.
Maybe I know people that believe this.
Uh-huh.
So I guess at the end when you go to the end, I mean, to me, because I don't have an appreciation for poetry, so I'm here. this is very abstract, so I appreciate it for being abstract. But once you break it down, it becomes less abstract to me reading it. But to me, this is a series of observations that this person is having an experience. There's a series of observations, seemingly abstract, but this is the sequence of what's there happening. And what the real experience is that this all feels like machines are being installed in my head. Mm-hmm. That someone is controlling my experience.
Yep.
And this is the most succinct way I can put it, but you wouldn't be able to help if I said it anymore.
Yep. I think that's great. Yeah. That's wonderful. Yeah.
Because I know people who tell me that all the time.
Paul?
I was late, so did I miss that you talked about what the current situation of Ash Manor is?
You weren't late.
We were hoping that you were bringing a report.
We were relying on you.
Okay.
Well, I asked, sorry, I don't want to make that moment.
No.
But as I read that now, and then I'm wondering also about the exclusive, or the sphere of civilized man. Is that part of the current situation of Ash Manor?
What do you think?
No, that's not what I asked. That's what you did
this time.
Well, I know, I've seen somebody else do that.
Turn right around and say,
I thought it dated the poem.
Okay.
What do you mean?
As to when it would have been written.
That expression, the sphere of civilized man.
Not human.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I see. I thought you meant like a philosophical concept that I missed or something.
Well, I think in some ways what's interesting about that is we've encountered all of these other things, all of these other nouns. We get Tex and Tulip and the cult and all of these things. And then all of a sudden it's sort of like you're walking along and it's like, well, here's a sad emotion that's sort of sitting on the ground or something like that, as though it's almost, you know, back to the asylum idea, it's sort of almost like outside of the body as like a thing that you would encounter. And that in some way, that as though we could categorize sadness. Here's a sad emotion, and this one belongs to the sphere of civilized man. Whereas maybe tomorrow you would be walking along and you would find a different kind of sadness, and this kind of sadness belongs somewhere else.
I think we all bring our own experiences into context. This rings a bell because when I was a young lawyer many, many years ago, I was appointed to represent an elderly woman who was put into a Harborview hospital in Seattle where the fifth floor was the mental ward. And she was losing her memory a little bit, but she was still sharp as a tack. But her sister put her in there, and we had to go through this whole process. And I remember sitting up in the ward, and all these crazy people were coming in out of the, it was a tough place. And I'm getting that same sort of feel. She was sharp, she could make these observations, but then all of these weird things around her, and then she started having not hallucinations, but she had these questions and these things, not ghosts, but, and this may have nothing whatsoever to do with what the author is getting at, but to just look at it out of the blue. That's why I say asylum, that's background. But I can see this person who's sharp, wanting to get out, observing things, and then all of a sudden having these other people impressions and other things happen.
Yeah.
And then the little dog, because I know that there was a time where they would bring animals into, even in that situation, and they would be attached to the dogs, and then they'd take them away. So
really?
That's the background that I am biased by this, so I probably, but it probably has nothing to do with what we're at, but that's why it kind of rings true to me.
I don't have that bias, and I felt the same thing. That who's crazy here?
Mm. Yeah.
The civilized world, or this person that's got all these dreamlike, surreal experiences? You know, and where are we? You know, where's reality and...
The outcome of this was really amazing. She went in front of a judge, and the judge asked her all these questions to determine whether she was committable or not. And the first thing the judge said was, who's the Secretary of State? And she said, Lud Cramer, who was the State Secretary of State for Washington, or I can't remember who the federal one was.
And you're crazy.
He said, no, he said, get out of here. He said, get out of here, too. I mean... So it was a good result. But yes, she was sharp, and he had these things that happened.
Yeah, you can see there's something about the reversals in here. I blew on the lock, it opened. I blew on the candle, it lit itself. These are reversals or inversions or whatever. And the more I read it, the more I think this is almost the way an individual might feel if their country were at war and every value was the reverse value. So that you're told that every name, every word you think you understood is now being used in reverse form. When it says a cult is formed whose solemn purpose to design new uniforms for the servants, I don't think you have to go to an institution and claim, you know, that somebody is over the edge into another kind of, quote, sanity to see that this is as much a part of daily life. It isn't inside another wall. A solemn purpose to design new uniforms for the servants? I mean, who wears uniforms? Cult is almost brainwashing. Mm-hmm. Who's got a solemn purpose? Solemn purpose. To go and what, save not just one country but the whole world for. There's something inverted.
So, and as you start to look at these inversions, then the line sort of between kind of what Paul is saying, who's going crazy, and what actually is another way of saying what we're experiencing, right? That our experience of the world in times of war or grief or anything like that can often feel as those things.
Inversing. And even that it's four line, and then in the end reduced to, I have one line to hold on to.
Great.
I have a dog. They want to take him away from me. It's like the clarity of machines. It feels like machines are being installed in my head that are reprogramming me for something else. Even the Texan tulip, the pet seals, there's a juxtaposition on in the media of the sublime and the ridiculous and the horrible and the silly.
Well, and we experience both of those things at the same time,
right?
Because, you know, there's not separating. And, okay, obviously...
I won't, but I've, afterwards on coffee, I have the sequel to this that's a powerful actual experience between
us. Good.
But I
we can all stay too, but, well, I actually want to get into that because I think it's so great. I was afraid that I was going to have to convince all of you of some of this stuff, but you picked up on it right away. And so what I want to talk about is that sometimes I think all of you are amazingly intelligent, so you picked up on it right away, but I think this is an example of a more contemporary poem. And I think sometimes that you might find in a journal or something like that. And sometimes the instinct, I think, is when we open contemporary poetry journals at this point to read part of this and be like, oh, come on, give me a break, what's going on, right? Because it's not what some people, it's not easy, right? It takes a little bit of getting into it and seeing what's going on till we begin to see that this is, this second to last line, especially, I have a little dog and they want to take him away from me. After, like Ricky's saying, after you read through all that, that line is heartbreaking. I mean, it is so grief-stricken and awful, but you have to be willing to take that journey. But I just think this is so interesting. I'm trying to think what order to do this in. Maybe let's do this other poem first.
I just say, I think the sad one for me is this one that goes my eyes, voices, my grief, burning eyes. And because it's an intro, it's before the culmination, but it's like they're still looking for something, to find something, some possibility or,
yes.
Or
I think it's an intro.
Way. And yet,
oh, good, so
you know,
that's true.
You think it's what?
It's anti-war poem.
Whoa! Let's get to this poem.
I think it's that thing that's got teeth grabbing around his throat. Oh, that's horrible.
Gotta see him. Okay. Well, this poem. Oh, I splashed a couple of this. So this poem, Ash Manor, was written. This is a much later poem. The poem you're holding now, The Lost Pilot, was written by James Tate. One of his first books when he was, not very old. I'm trying to think. He wrote this poem when he was at the Iowa Writers Workshop as well, so similar, probably mid-20s maybe. And I'm going to read the poem. We won't comment on it just yet. And then I'm going to read you some things from one of his essays, too. And then I want to re-talk about the Ash Manor poem in light. The stuff that it's amazing. You guys are already picking up on all of it. But using some of his autobiography, you can really see where he's coming from. But so this is The Lost Pilot for My Father, 1922 to 1944. Your face did not rot like the others. The co-pilot, for example, I saw him yesterday. His face is corn mush. His wife and daughter, the poor ignorant people, stare as if he will compose soon. He was more wronged than Job. But your face did not rot like the others. It grew dark and hard like ebony. The features progressed in their distinction. If I could cajole you to come back for an evening, down from your compulsive orbiting, I would touch you, read your face as Dallas, your hoodlum gunner, now with the blistered eyes, reads his Braille editions. I would touch your face as a disinterested scholar touches an original page. However frightening, I would discover you, and I would not turn you in. I would not make you face your wife, or Dallas, or the co-pilot, Jim. You could return to your crazy orbiting, and I would not try to fully understand what it means to you. All I know is this. When I see you, as I have seen you at least once every year of my life, spin across the wilds of the sky like a tiny African god, I feel dead. I feel as if I were the residue of a stranger's life, that I should pursue you. My head cocked toward the sky, I cannot get off the ground. And you, passing over again, fast, perfect, and unwilling to tell me what you are doing well, or that it was a mistake that placed you in that world and me in this, or that misfortune placed these worlds in us. So, James Tate's father, as I said sort of in my introduction, was a pilot in World War II, and he was shot down over Germany. James Tate never met him. It was right before he was about to come home and meet James Tate for the first time. And the plane was shot down, and everybody else on the plane either survived and went to different camps, or they found bodies of, and they never found the body of his father. Mm-hmm. It was never clear what happened to him. And so for years and years, they kept thinking maybe he was going to turn up, that maybe he was going to show up. And one of the other people on the plane, his name was Roy, friends of the father, actually came back, and his wife was best friends with James Tate's mother. And so this man was always around, and he could never quite say what happened. Or if he would say what happened, the stories would change all the time. And so they were constantly living without knowing if he was coming back or what had happened. And clearly this poem is a result of that. But not only that, but in this, and I wrote these, that poem we just read is obviously from The Lost Pilot, which is the first book of poems. I'm now just going to read a couple selections from this essay called The Route is Briefed, which is also by James Tate, and it's just an autobiographical essay about his wife, or his life. Although, interestingly enough, in this essay about himself, he refers to himself as Tommy Woods. I don't know why, and one of my teachers asked him once, and he didn't really give a response. So, it's autobiographical, theoretically, but he refers to himself by a different name. So I'm just going to read some sections because I think it becomes clear not only is he dealing with the death of his father, but he had some really weird things happen to him. Some funny, in fact, and some just horrible. Okay, so this is talking about his father. During the war, we were living with my grandma and Grandpa Clinton. Grandpa Clinton worked for the Federal Reserve Bank longer than any man in their national history. He was a very mild, level-headed man, one who refused to go to church with the rest of the family. One night, he sat up from his sleep and said to my grandmother, "Virgil has just been shot down over Germany." He woke the whole family and told them. Then he sat up alone the rest of the night and waited for the telegram. They never found him. The rest of the crew was accounted for. Some were wounded, some were dead, and some were in prison camps. Roy Weaver, my father's best friend and co-pilot, was in a prison camp. His wife, Mildred, was my mother's best friend. and skips them. And then the war was over. No one in our house knew how to celebrate the great victory for which everyone at home had pulled so selflessly. We didn't feel like we had won. But you had to act happy for those whose beloved men did come back in one piece or pretty near. So you're noticing, I'm sure, conflict in terms of emotions. Okay, so then his mother starts to date people. She starts to date this man named Joe Quincy. My mother hadn't bothered to find out much about Joe Quincy before she married him. In that first couple of weeks, Joe and I ended up alone in the house several nights when my mother worked late at the Chrome Fixture Company. The first night, I was alone on the floor of my room lining up 100 lead soldiers in impeccable rows when Joe came in and knelt down beside me. He smiled warmly but tensely and said, "Ever seen one of these before, Tommy?" I looked down, and there was a gun in his hand. "It's a 38," he said. I didn't know what to say. "Here, go ahead, hold it," he said, pulling it out next to my hand on my knee. "Is it loaded?" I asked, stalling. "Do you want it to be?" he said. "No," I said. It was loaded, and now he took the real bullets out and put them on the floor by my cannons. "It's heavier than I thought," I said. "Go ahead and pull the trigger," he said. "At what?" I asked. "At anything," he said. "Shoot your lamp out." "All right," I said, and tried to hold the gun up with my one hand steady enough to take aim at my lamp. "You would have missed it," he said. "How come?" "Because you were shaking. Use both hands this time. Hold it out in front of your chin, that's right." I admit I thought it was a bit peculiar to have my brand new stepfather teaching me to shoot the light out of my room with a 38. Though it could have been easily explained. All the men I knew hunted and were proud of their rifles. Joe didn't leave much room for interpretation, though. He started telling me about crime and gangsters in Chicago. He didn't say exactly what he had done there, but it was strongly implied that he had used the pistol on more than one occasion, and even that it was not too safe for him to be back there right now. There was a certain amount of pride in the way he related the picture. So, at some point, they end up... Joe ends up being in... There's some incidents where Joe and his mother fight like mad, and the gun goes off in their house a bunch of times. And at one point, the gun goes off and it shoots holes in the floor. The next day, I was sent down to the hardware store on Prospect to buy some plastic wood in a tube. And I got to spend 3 or 4 hours that afternoon and evening filling up the holes. It was still pretty conspicuous when I got done, but at least you wouldn't stub your toe in one of the holes. Okay? So do you see that all of it's like this bordering between just horrible and guys. And you can't, I mean, it's, so they escape, they have to, like, take him to Detroit and hide and all of this stuff. My mother and I were back in Kansas City 3 days later. At school, my friend said, "You been sick?" "No," I said, "I've been on vacation." "Where to?" they asked disbelievingly. "Detroit," I answered proudly. My mother and I stayed in the new old house alone. I got a pet alligator and 2 birds from Japan. It was quiet now, blah, blah, blah. Occasionally, one of my friends would ask, "How's your new dad?" And I'd have to answer, "I don't know." I didn't really know what had happened to him. We were all hysterical for a couple of days hiding around at Joe's old hoodlum friends in Detroit. Then they got it with the police, but I don't really remember how. In fact, for many years, I didn't even know what for. Then my mother's youngest sister, Marty, told me one night. "Whatever happened to Joe?" I asked her years later. "He got the electric chair," she said matter-of-factly. "What for?" I asked. "Didn't you know, Tommy?" she said. "Joe killed his first wife." Oh, my God. Okay, so this just... Okay, let me just... I'm going to read, like, two other... I just... Okay. I never did make too many friends in that neighborhood. And again, I mean, it's written as autobiography, but okay, so I never did make too many friends in that neighborhood. The old lady next door who called the police when Joe shot off his .45 went crazy one night and carved up by 5 rabbits. Oh. I discovered them the next morning, parts hurled savagely all over the backyard. I knew she had done it, and though I was afraid of her, I pulled at my chest, crossed my fingers, and rang her doorbell. She pretended not to know I was there. I finally found my voice, and just as I found it, broke into tears, grumbling, "You You killed my rabbits. I had her there. She couldn't lie in the face of such a passionate accusation as I delivered. Yes, she said, she had killed my rabbits in the night. They were getting into her garden and eating all her carrots.
Goodness.
Okay, then the last part I'm going to read. Is this okay? Is it interesting? Okay. So, he goes, so his mother starts dating this other man whose nicer name is Jarvis.
Who's nicer? That doesn't say too much.
No, but they send Tommy, a.k.a. James, away to Rotary Camp. And Rotary Camp is a really weird place. right. We were led rigidly through certain sports and events each day. It was the rigidity that made me nervous. Just as I was beginning to enjoy the baseball game or the swim or whatever, there was a whistle in my ears telling me to quick throw that down and pick this up. This also made it difficult to make any friends. 20 minutes to the second for each meal, no talking after lights out. If the army is a vacation, then I was in the army. In my spare minutes between the events of the day, I began to take an interest in the tarantula and scorpion populations that thrived all over the campgrounds and surrounding woods. First, we found them in our beds at night, both tarantulas and scorpions. Though the tarantulas presented a more powerfully hideous view to the eye, we were told the scorpions were the ones to watch out for. A scorpion would be just as happy to sting you in your sleep, while the tarantula would either cuddle up beside you or pass on by. I got to be known right away for my fearlessness with regard to tarantulas. I watched them and knew their ways, knew how to handle them, and indeed was not in the least afraid after a while to let a perfectly virile tarantula, fully fanged, walk across my naked shoulders and down my arm into my hand, where I would stroke his hair affectionately and with caution. Okay, so then, this is amazing. One morning, we were told in the breakfast speeches that it was Frank Buck Day, and we should all get out there and really work hard catching snakes so that our tent would get the most points and win. They would give out awards that night after dinner around the swimming pool. They said our parents had been invited, and many of them would be there. I must not have been listening because I didn't understand what was meant by Frank Buck Day, and therefore none of the rest of what was said made any sense to me. I was supposed to go out there and help my tent win, and then maybe my mother would be there at the swimming pool tonight. So basically, they're all supposed to run around and catch as many snakes as they can during the course of the day. So all the boys are running around catching snakes, and he's not really into it. So he only catches a couple really small snakes. And so the tradition at this horrible camp, is that whoever catches the least amount of snakes gets dressed up as the queen of Frank Buck Day. So they grab him and take him to a shed. All the parents are sitting around the swimming pool for this award ceremony. They've been invited for the boys to see who has caught the most poisonous snakes. And the other kids have grabbed him and dressed him up in women's apparel. Just when Alan and another guy had finished screwing a pair of dangling earrings on me, I heard the camp leader saying, "And now, folks, there's one last award we give each year, and that is to the camper that catches the least snakes in our Frank Buck Day Bring 'em Back Alive snake catching competition. We call that award our Queen of Frank Buck Day Award." There was tremendous laughter. Alan grabbed me roughly under my arm and dragged me into the light around the diving board where the camp leader was standing with his bullhorn. "And our Queen of Frank Buck Day this year is Miss Tabby Woods, who caught all by herself 3 itsy-bitsy ringnecks about this long." The parents and the campers were really laughing very hard now. The campers were yelling things. "Come on up here, Queen Tommy," the camp leader said, standing on the diving board. "You aren't afraid of water, too, are you?" "No," I said. "We have a prize for you." "Yes, we do," he said. I had on high heels, so it was hard to walk. They were too big, and I kept threatening to crash on either side with each step forward I took. When I got up on the diving board with the camp leader, I was in such a state of embarrassment and humiliation, I was afraid to look at anyone, afraid to see if my mother and Jarvis had come. The camp leader was saying some funny things that I couldn't hear, and then someone came up behind me and handed him one end of the most enormous black snake I have ever seen. It was 6 feet long and 12 inches around in the middle. Alan and the camp leader stretched the snake out to its full length in front of the audience, which responded with appropriate sighs and gasps. Then the camp leader said something into the bullhorn I didn't hear, and they began to wrap the snake. It was, I remember, he said, the camp's mascot of many years, around my neck. When it was wrapped around several times, Alan handed me its tail to hold in my right hand, and the camp leader gave me its head to hold in the other. There was a burst of appreciation from the parents' gallery. And then Alan and the camp leader pushed me off the diving board into the deep end of the pool. I expected the snake to strangle me, but apparently it had been through this enough times to be interested only in disentangling itself from my neck and saving itself. By the time I surfaced, white with fear, my makeup running and my mop wig turned around sideways, everyone seemed to have forgotten about the coronation ceremonies. They were standing in threes and fours and discussing the wonderful opportunities the camp offered. The campers were giving their parents hot pads and lariats they had made for them, and the parents had Kool-Aid packages and Fritos for their sons. I just wanted to creep through them as inconspicuously as possible and get back to the tent to change into dry jeans and scrub the lipstick off my face. I heard my name called. Tommy. My mother came up through the crowd to me, and I felt ashamed to be standing there in that outfit, pained that she had seen me made a fool of out there in front of everyone. I desperately didn't want her to make a joke about it. That was terrible, she said. I couldn't say anything. I was holding back. So, I know that I've given you a lot of information, but in light of those things, in light of this poem, well, first let me say one thing, which is that I don't think ever that we should have to rely on autobiography in order to know how to read a poem. Certainly reading that poem, Ash Manor, the first time, you guys picked up on all of this stuff. And now, reading his autobiography and reading this poem about his father, I mean, all of this stuff you listed was, I mean, an inherent part of his life. The reason that I was interested in kind of wanted to talk about this session, I want to hear what you guys have to say too in the last couple minutes here, is just that I think in The Lost Pilot, that poem, the second poem we looked at that was written first, it's very confessional. It's very obvious that this is a story about his father and this is the grief that he is dealing with. In Ash Manor, though you picked up on that emotion, it's made a lot more convoluted in certain ways. We arrive at that emotion very differently. But I think that that grief is an inherent part of both poems. And so I guess I just want to make the point that, especially as I think when we are dealing with grief, that's a time at which a lot of people turn to writing, even if they're not writers themselves, or you don't write that much, that sometimes we want to write through grief, that there are so many different ways to go about that in writing, and so many different ways that it can be manifested and made apparent. And this is just one poet, and sort of his journey of dealing with that grief has been going at it in a lot of kind of different directions. Does that kind of make sense? What do you guys, I mean, hearing all of this stuff and reading, what do you throw out what you're thinking or feeling or?
Well, yesterday you indicated both the poets yesterday had actually ended up committing suicide. Is he still alive? Did he have mental problems, or do you know of?
Not that I know of. He, the Lost Pilot from that first book, won the Yale Younger Poet Series, and then he went on to win the Pulitzer Prize for his collected poems. And he currently teaches at the University of Massachusetts MFA program. And he's been very, critics hated him for a really long time. They couldn't figure out how to read poems like this when they didn't know what to do with it. And he's still a sort of a controversial figure in that way. People aren't sure.
They didn't know how to read The Lost Pilot?
No, The Ash Manor. Because they got used to once more like, oh, and that's a great point. The other just sort of historical thing is that he kind of arrived at the time when confessional poetry which we looked, Sylvia Plath we looked at yesterday, Anne Sexton, people like that. Confessional poetry is really talking about specifically what's happening in a very real way in front of you in your own life. That was sort of, had been in vogue and was just sort of kind of going out of style. On the other hand, more in Europe, but sort of coming across the ocean, was surrealism, surrealist poetry. And so what James Tate was often labeled was as a domestic surrealist, in the sense that he took the surrealism motif and really made it domestic, brought it into the home. And you could see why he would become a domestic surrealist when his actual home life was so naturally surreal. Yeah, Paul?
One of the thoughts you gave me the thought. Poetry, I think, is not only about something, about an experience. It is an experience.
Absolutely.
And my, sorry for the language, I don't know how else to put it, this guy survived a really fucked up world.
Yeah.
And that's represented in this experience that we've felt.
Yeah, absolutely. The experience of reading Ash Manor is the experience of, Other thoughts, comments?
That's the sense I got, too, is that having heard the memoir part in this poem and not really getting right away that he was also the poet that wrote Ash Manor, I felt a sense of relief that he had survived to give us this. And his consciousness about his own survival seems to come to me.
Deeply sad.
Yeah.
It's really disappointing. I think part of it because in some ways it's refreshing to know that he has been rewarded and he found an outlet that was rewardable. But that his life and his work has always had to be scrutinized through a lens that was not his own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that his work survived that.
Is the act of writing, though, ultimately an act of affirmation? I mean, if you're so despaired, you know, about it, you can be married, you know, do you write? I don't know, that's the question. All writing some kind of affirmation of life?
Yes, but you can get brought down pretty quickly. It can be, you can get shut down very quickly if somebody says that you're not telling the right story, or not telling the story well, or it's not interesting, or
and you put your head in your
That Rotary Camp experience had to have had something to do with the basis of this poem, though. It seemed to me that he wasn't institutionalized, but yet that camp was almost, I mean, I may be reading too much into it, but some of those experiences almost as he was.
Yep.
But it would have been totally different if his mother hadn't said at the end, "This that was awful." If she hadn't affirmed that fact, if she had come down on him for him being the queen, whatever it is,
more accepted as normal, acceptable.
Yeah.
But she could have been totally
different. He had a witness.
Yeah.
Well, and in some ways, you hear that sort of clarity in that last, in that second to last line of Ash Manor, where it's, "I had a little dog and they took it away from me." That sort of, there's that clear voice at the end that says, this is about, they did something and it was wrong, you know, like clarity of emotion.
Was that his rabbit?
Well, I don't think, you know, I mean, this is why, like, I think it's always dangerous to introduce autobiography because then, of course, we want to, like, link it too closely up, and I think the imaginative world of the poet, you know, can be completely separate from autobiography, certainly. So that's not my point at all. Or that you would have had to read his autobiography in order to understand Ash Manor, because big point here is you guys got all of it before reading any of the autobiography. You picked up on every single one of those things. But I just wanted to show you, in one instance at least, where that was coming from.
I go back to
Paul said anti-war, and I think I was getting there. You've got a whole generation in any country at war, you've got a whole generation of men who are going to have the line, I have a life. And it has been taken from them, whether it's the physical life or the emotional life that they can't live under the conditions of, and even his scene of, under the conditions of being in war and not coming home with loss.
Yeah.
Can you? Even the scene of the man showing the little boy how to shoot a gun. I mean, that isn't an isolated case. There's how many thousands of men being, boys being taught how to shoot a gun. Like, he's a voice to be reckoned with, it seems to me. And pointing out the madness that we are normalizing. The longer you live with a country of war, the more it's normalized.
And the camp experience was normal, and that's what makes me so sad. So let's not assume that, oh, that poor golden child he experienced it.
Yeah.
So much to suit him.
Even the snake.
That was normal then.
Yeah.
That was normal then. I mean,
even the snake.
Yes, somebody should have. I mean, his mom did witness, but somebody should have stopped it. That's what losing his dog is about.
Yeah.
I mean, you had someone in authority there, a parent, any parent, the camp directors, something like that. I remember I was at camps, 50 years ago, and kids that were a little different would get tortured.
Yep.
Either by other campers or by, weird, things they put people through. It's kind of brutal.
How many of you know gay people who never come home again?
Yeah.
Because the world is fucked up.
Well, church. They never go to church.
Well, I've gone 5 minutes over, so I should officially end it now. Thank you guys so much for coming.
You
being so smart.
I'll do it at coffee. If anyone wants to hear it, we're going to have to come.